Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Sarah.
And I'm back in LA.
We're so excited.
We're so excited to be back in the same room together.
Obviously this hasn't been recorded because it was, you know, pre-recording.
Right.
But we just erupted into, like, the biggest giggle fest
we did.
Of all time. Like, I think when we're gone from each other for so long, it just erupts. Like, we could not stop joking and laughing, and I was finally like, Devin, we have to sit down and record.
I was like, fine.
So I think this is going to be a fun episode.
It is.
We have a lot of pent-up energy from being away from each other for so long.
We got jokes!
but we do have a packed show.
Yes.
We've talked in recent podcasts, this is really cute of us, we've talked about, like, trying to keep it, like, a tight 1:10, or 1:10.
Right.
On Thursdays, we always go long. It's usually, like, an hour 25, hour 30.
Right.
I think this is one that's going to be pushing 2 hours. Like, I just...
Hellions, buckle the fuck up.
Buckle up. We make no promises about this being short, because there's so much to discuss.
Yes.
So let me go through what we're going to be talking about today. So, as always, we start off the show with listener feedback and Hellbent updates. Then we get into our, we're going to jump right into Russia. Usually mm-hmm. we do sort of like a Trumpland bullshit block and then Russia. We're jumping right in because shit be bananas.
Bananas.
So, excuse me. Shit be bananas. And Devin titled this block, Jesus fucking Christ, Donald Trump Jr. And then in parentheses, Russia.
Russia. in case it wasn't clear.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about that bombshell New York Times story, as well as a few other stories surrounding it that are flying below the radar because of how big this New York Times story is, but are crucial to the overall Trump-Russia picture.
Right. They're giving some really important context.
Yeah.
It's getting real.
Again, this is going to be like a two-hour show. then we get into block three, which is Jesus fucking Christ healthcare. And these are all shouty all caps.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I don't do not all caps when talking about healthcare or Russia.
And then we get into our interview with Tracy Chow, who is a very prominent woman in tech. She's an entrepreneur, software engineer, and diversity advocate. So we had a really great conversation with her about her work and also as tech intersects with politics.
She is awesome.
She's really awesome, really smart. Then we get into our gratitude check.
Yes.
You know we need it, especially today.
Darkest timeline of loss.
Yes. And then finally, you know, on Thursdays, we like to do our Maxine Waters update and the Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. And then to cap everything off, we have our action items. So we have a few different things that are really important that we wanted to talk about there.
Okay, Sarah, so let's get into some listener feedback and updates. And our first piece of feedback is people just making fun of me, which is fine. I'm fine with it.
Yeah, so we had quite a few corrections on some pronunciation because both Devin and I have not seen The Godfather.
Right.
Just going to put that
out. Just put out there.
Because we were talking about how Donald Trump Jr., people within Trump's inner circle were comparing him to one of the characters in The Godfather. So, you know, people were like, it's pronounced Fredo. Although there was different ones.
Yes.
Stephanie said it's pronounced Fredo. Carmela said it's Fredo. And then she was like, Corleone.
And then a facepalm emoji. I felt like was necessary.
Yeah. So apologies for the mispronunciation on names from movies we've never seen. But thank you for the corrections. And also let us know if it's Fredo or Fredo.
Fredo. Yeah. Oh, or is this going to be another like booby bird debate?
Boobies.
Not just Barbie. Right.
Boobies.
Boobies.
Yeah. Right. It might be. And then LL on Twitter said, had to press pause after your segment on Ivanka at the G20 because I loved it so much. I had to tell you immediately. A perfect analysis.
Oh, that's so nice. But we could talk about her fake-ass feminist all day.
Yeah, I mean, her feminism,
her fake-ass feminist ass. How's that?
We could really do it all day. And then Rachel quoted us from the last pod. She was quoting something I said, quote, there's a braveness and hope. And then she said, this is applicable to so much these days. Hashtag blessed by this podcast. And thank you, Rachel. We feel hashtag blessed to have everyone as listeners.
We do.
You friends are so great.
You guys are
friends.
You even said it.
Said you were like embracing y'all.
I am embracing y'all.
Yeah, so you can start working that into your repertoire.
Okay, I'm going to say y'all.
Yeah.
We also had an email from Dolly, one of our listeners, actually about our conversation about the South.
Right.
So I'm going to read a little portion of it here. She said, quote, it was really depressing and disheartening to hear you both laughing at the backwardsness here. The derisive tone in your voices was clear. Devin, I'm sorry that you had a weird interaction with a guy in Gatlinburg. I'm two counties over from there, by the way. But please don't take it out on the rest of us. Have a great time in Nashville. Enjoy the fact that the city has a progressive woman mayor. And try to see the beauty of our state and the interesting culture we have to offer. And I would just like to say that I'm very sorry if I sounded derisive. I thoroughly enjoyed my time in Tennessee, both Gatlinburg and Nashville. And I did have a weird moment with the person in Gatlinburg, but I've also had weird moments with people on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
I feel like it's not like location specific. I was not laughing, certainly not laughing at people in Tennessee, though I was thoroughly confused by the lizard people comment because I genuinely had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, we realize that intent is definitely different from impact.
Absolutely.
So we're both of us are definitely sorry that you felt like we were looking down upon the state as a whole. And to anyone else who felt similarly, we're very sorry.
Yeah, that was not our intent at all.
Yeah, but we realize the impacts can be different. So thank you, Dolly, for the note. Again, if you want to send us any kind of feedback, including critical feedback, which we always love, it's hellbentpodcastla@gmail.com. Now let's move on to some updates on our end. The monthly newsletter will come out on Friday, so you can sign up at hellbentpodcast.com/newsletter. And then on Patreon for $5 supporters, we have our first bonus podcast in a while because we were on break.
Right.
So we're going to be talking about Betsy DeVos's education department and bullshit around how they're handling campus rape issues.
If you'd like to feel extra stabby today.
You might have, if you follow us on Twitter, you might have seen a quote from one of the officials in the department, and we literally just quote tweeted it and said, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. So we're going to get...
It felt appropriate.
Yeah. I ran out of character.
You're right.
So we're going to be talking about that. Jeff Sessions and Dare, as well as an update on the FBI investigation into Jane Sanders, which is heating up.
Schadenfreude is real, y'all.
So that's on Patreon. And then Devin.
Yes. Another little announcement. I know we just took a break, but we won't be here for next Thursday's episode. I'm going to Comic-Con.
Yes.
So I've been waiting to go to Comic-Con for 5 years.
5 years.
I've been trying to get tickets for 5 years. So I'm very excited. And if there are any Hellions that are going to Comic-Con or will be in the area in San Diego, I'd love to get together. Maybe we can like do a little Facebook group or figure out where we can all meet up.
And maybe tweet at Devin.
Yeah, tweet at me at Devin Handy and we can figure it out. And we can talk comics and politics and everything will be right in the world.
Yeah, just solve all of our problems at Comic-Con.
At Comic-Con.
So yeah, we will be back on Monday, but next Thursday, is that the 20th?
20th.
Devin will be gone.
Yes. All right, Sarah. This is a beast, so everyone, I'll say it again, needs to buckle the fuck up.
Yeah.
We are about to get in some deep shit, y'all.
With Russia.
With Russia. So, Jesus fucking Christ, Donald Trump Jr., Sarah.
Again, buckle the fuck up. We have a lot. Devin was like, she looked at the outline this morning, and she was like, Jesus fucking Christ, the outline.
Yeah, right?
I mean, everything is all caps. So, yeah. There was... I don't even know how to start, because there's so much to unpack,
yeah.
But... You know, it didn't take long for this Donald Trump Jr. story to explode. I mean, we discussed separate New York Times reporting from over the weekend on Monday's podcast. And then by Tuesday morning, it was just at a whole new level.
That's because we're a good luck charm for the news cycle.
Right.
As soon as we record.
I also think just like there are 7 news cycles in any given day.
That's also very true.
Yeah. So before the New York Times released their latest bombshell story, Donald Trump Jr. tweeted out... the contents of his emails with the people who set up that meeting with the Russian lawyer. You can't see, but Devin is like...
I'm trying not to laugh into the microphone.
And he did because the New York Times were telling him, like, we're going to publish it.
So I think
he was trying to get out ahead of it. And he was trying to be like, look how transparent I am. It's like, no.
No.
But still, I can't believe he would tweet them out.
Right.
Like, it's one thing for them to appear in the newspaper. And,
right.
Like, you to, like, distance yourself a little bit.
Right.
But he literally, he thought that would be a good idea. Like, what? And I love the way NBC News's Kristen Welker put it. She had spoken to a former Clinton campaign official, or at least she was quoting this person, who said that the news of Donald Trump Jr.'s emails is, quote, the SNL version of what we always suspected what was going on.
I mean, that's the perfect way to put it.
It's the perfect way to put it because the subject of the email was literally, quote, Russia, Clinton, private and confidential. Like,
it's so good. I mean, it's so perfect. I couldn't have written this better myself.
It cannot be any more fucking obvious than that. It was really funny to watch Chris Hayes try to digest this.
Right.
I don't know if it was on Twitter or on his show, but he was like, I just didn't think it would be like this, like, direct,
right,
and this obvious,
right,
like to the subject line,
right. Like, no, it's amazing.
Even the people who like really felt like collusion was there probably didn't think that there was like a smoking gun of sorts. Oh, like this.
I didn't. I mean, I knew there's collusion going on, and I knew these connections would come out eventually.
Yeah,
I did not think it was going to be Trump's son. That was a surprise to me. Well, and if we remember back in February or 16,000 years ago in Trump years. Manafort said, quote, it's not like these people wear badges that say, I'm a Russian intelligence officer, but hello, that is literally exactly what this email said. And it was forwarded to Manafort.
Yeah. And it had this line. This is part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump.
It's amazing.
No, all of you guys are fucking liars. All of you, like literal guys.
Literal guys. Yeah. All you guys.
Are fucking liars. And, you know, someone, I think it was Maddo yesterday, made a good point. You know, the way they were talking about this meeting, it made it sound like they were already aware of Russia's efforts to help Trump. Because it,
right.
Like, if that was like the first you'd heard of it, you would have been like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And also, like, you know, people who have done campaigns are like, that would not be my response. Like,
right.
People who are seasoned professionals, which we'll get into. But also of note, the Steele dossier, you know, mentioned that the Putin regime was funneling anti-Hillary info to the Trump camp. And as Reza Aslan said on Twitter, little by little, everything in the Steele dossier is proving true.
Right. So we keep talking about how that was an unverified, like, package of documents. But, you know, these kind of pieces are coming out. They keep
being corroborated.
Corroborated. That's okay.
Yeah. So basically what we're saying is the P tape is real.
The P tape is real.
We're going to put money on that.
Release the P tape. So here are the new deets. On June 3rd, 2016.
Yeah. So this is from the New York Times story.
So we're giving
a little context first. Now here's what was in the New York Times story with Donald Trump Jr.'s emails.
Right. What we actually know. So one of his fathers, so Donald Trump's former Russian business partners, Rob Goldstone, had been contacted by a senior Russian government official and was offering to provide the Trump campaign with dirt on Hillary Clinton.
So this was June 3rd, 2016.
Right. Goldstone then told Trump Jr. that he was writing on behalf of a mutual friend, one of Russia's biggest pop music stars, Emin.
I think it's Amin.
Amin? Mm-hmm. Okay, Amin. So Amin's father is sometimes called the, quote, Donald Trump of Russia.
Which is just perfect.
Which is perfect, and boasts close ties to the Russian president, Putin.
Yeah.
Vladimir Putin. And so they said that these documents would, quote, incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This was in the email. This is a direct quote from the email. Like, this is not, like, analysis.
No, this is in the email.
This was released by Donald Trump Jr. on Twitter. Just so we're all clear on this. He also said, quote, this is obviously very high level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump. Again, direct quote.
And you know, Trump Jr. replied within minutes. If it's what you say, I love it, especially in the summer, which I loved. One Twitter user said, she was like, isn't this a Demi Lovato lyric?
It is. And that was a banger.
I love it, especially later in the summer. And then second of all, as we sort of mentioned previously, pretty much every seasoned campaign professional I follow on Twitter was like, basically like, if a foreign country came to me with dirt on my opponent, my first call would be to like the FBI.
Right.
And these were Democrats and Republicans alike.
Right.
They were like, this is bananas.
Right.
There's no way we would act the way Trump Jr. acted.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, so again, the precise nature of the promised damaging information about Clinton is unclear, and there's no evidence to suggest that it was related to the Russian government hacking that led to those DNC emails being released.
Right.
Regardless, though, I think this is important to remember. Like, regardless what Don Jr. received or did not receive, and again, I think we're only at the tip of the iceberg with this story. I think there's so much more that's going to come out. So regardless of what he got, this is direct evidence of coordination between top levels of Trump's campaign and Russia. I mean, this is a smoking gun of sorts.
Yeah, and this isn't just like some random dickwad like Paul Manafort, who's not random, but this is...
He was the campaign
manager. He was the campaign manager, not that random. But this is Donald Trump's son.
Right.
This is not, you know, this is not like a 6 degrees situation.
Yeah, and, you know, someone on Twitter likened it to that show To Catch a Predator.
Right.
They were like, you know, a creepy dude shows up with the expectation of engaging in, like, an illegal act, but But being thwarted from doing so doesn't stop that from being wrong.
Right.
So the fact that Trump Jr. took this meeting, regardless of what he got, that's wrong.
Right.
There's a lot wrong with that.
Just that specifically. And then I think my favorite part of this whole story, personally, is that the Goldstone dickwad, this guy who emailed Trump Jr., legitimately checked in to the Trump Tower on Facebook on June 9th with the status, quote, preparing for meeting. I mean, could these assholes be worse at this?
Yeah, so some of these emails exchanges, I can't even, like, process that. Like, that's, like, and his Facebook is still public, I think. Like, he hasn't changed the privacy.
No.
But, like, yeah, so the initial email was June 3rd.
Right.
The meeting itself took place on June 9th.
And he checked, Goldstone checked into Trump Tower on Facebook with the status preparing for meeting.
Also a big red flag as it pertains to Trump Sr. Because, again, he's trying to distance himself saying, I didn't know anything about this.
Right.
So a Twitter user who named Pay Resist said, quote, I just ran Lexis news article searches. Trump never mentioned Hillary's 33,000 emails before June 9th, 2016. After that, he mentioned it almost daily. So, like, I have a very hard time believing that Trump wasn't at least briefed on this meeting when it happened.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's no way he didn't know. Everyone's lying and everyone knows everything.
Yeah. And there's been other, like, interesting timeline notes that have happened. So,
right.
Yashar Ali, who's a journalist, as he pointed out on Twitter, in terms of the timing, so June 7th at 5:16 p.m. is when Don Jr. confirmed the meeting with the Russian lawyer. And then on June 7th at 9:13 p.m., so within 4 hours, that's when Trump had that press availability where he promised a press conference the following week with Clinton Dirt.
That's right.
Like, he was like, we've got some things.
That's right.
Yeah. So there's just no way
there's
that he was
no
in the
way.
Dark.
Absolutely not.
So the big question, I think, on everyone's mind is this treason?
Right. So, Sarah, is this treason?
So my friend, Jay Willis, he wrote a very thorough and funny explainer for GQ. He's really great. And I highly recommend reading it. We'll put it on the show notes. So here's the gist. From Jay's article, quote, it doesn't mean, of course, that various people in the Trump orbit couldn't be charged with other crimes for attempting to collude with alleged agents of the Russian government. It just means that, legally speaking, treason is in a category all its own, and it doesn't look like what Donald Trump Jr. fits into. So basically, this article was like, the framers were intimately familiar with the potential for treason to be used as a weapon against political
right.
opponents. So the definition is pretty narrow.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
Which makes sense. But again, like Jay said, it doesn't mean that, legally speaking, they're not in hot water.
Right. It's just not treason water.
It's not treason. From what he thinks.
Right. Yeah. So to put this all into perspective,
yeah.
Here's a quick top-level summary of the first 6 months of this banana's presidency. Trump Jr. confessed to collusion. Sessions likely committed perjury. Sessions and the Kush lied on their SF-86s. Trump admitted obstruction of justice. Flynn was fired 24 days into his tenure for, quote, lying to Mike Pence about conversations with Kislyak. It's been one hot fucking mess.
Yeah, and I loved all the excuses that came out. Pence was like, listen, this was before I was brought on. Like, Manafort was like, I didn't read the whole email. Like, Trump Sr. is like, my son's a high quality person. And then Trump Jr. literally went on Fox News and was like, I can't help what people send me. Like, no. You realize, do you understand how email works? Because you've applied.
Right. He does not.
He does not. I also, you know, speaking of dickwads, I would also like to take this moment to read some. To read aloud some extremely bad takes from alt-left dude bros that were really never going to age well. So this is from a January Washington Post article titled, quote, some on the left want Democrats to move on from Russia hacking. So Dave Lindorf wrote in Counterpunch, quote, we just went through 8 years of insane, nonstop Republican paranoia claiming that Barack Obama was a secret Muslim plant in the White House or a secret communist or incredibly both. How different are the liberal Democrats who are breathlessly claiming that this new president is a puppet, wittingly or unwittingly, of the evil Russian puppet master Vladimir Putin? And then the Young Turks, Jordan Cheriton, said, quote, "The breathless, hysterical marching band among establishment Democrats isn't much different than Republican cries over fake controversies like Benghazi." Oh, sweetie.
Sweetie. Oh, sweet, sweetie. Sweet child, baby sweet. Angel.
That's cute.
That's cute.
And also, let's never forget that Intercept article
right.
From a couple months back, that the headline was, quote, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow sees a Russia connection lurking around every corner. Like, that's because there is one, bitch.
You know, you reading these out loud, Schadenfreude is real, y'all.
I mean, listen, like Neera Tanden put it on Twitter, quote, "When it all comes out, it'll be both the GOP and lefties who attacked liberals for caring about Russian assault on our democracy who take big reputation hits." And I believe that.
Like you said, RIP these reputations.
RIP so many reputations lost. So where does that leave us in our fucking democracy? Like, I'm honestly appalled that, like, shit was still going on like normal.
Right.
Like, there was, like, a nomination hearing.
Oh, yeah.
For the new FBI director, like...
Oh, yeah, people are carrying on, like, this is totally normal and fine, and it's fucking not.
Yeah, I mean, like, as Rachel Maddow put it on a recent show, in any normal political circumstances, we would be at the end already.
Oh, it's so true. But, you know, this is Trump's America.
Ugh.
So, Orrin Hatch says... Trump Jr.'s emails are, quote, overblown, and Paul Ryan is being his usual spineless dickwad self. And, you know, like you said, they're carrying on with confirmation hearings. And
then trying to, like, push forward this healthcare bill.
Yeah.
I'm like,
stop.
I feel like I'm losing my mind.
Yes, just a little bit.
Like, I'm like, how is this happening?
I know.
This is not normal.
It's not.
But I think we're going to learn a lot more soon.
Yes.
I think this is just the tip of the iceberg.
I've said it before, I'll say it again. It took more than 900 days
right.
to resolve the Nixon Watergate scandal. Again, looking back at history, it doesn't feel like it because it's, you know, mm-hmm. 3 pages in a textbook.
Yeah.
But this is going to take some time. We're only, what,
6 months in.
We're 6 months in. So this will happen.
Knock on wood. I don't know if I've talked about this on the podcast, but in a Facebook group I'm in, someone wrote, like, months ago about how she went to some psychic conference and all, like, the psychics apparently agreed that something big's gonna happen to Donald Trump on August 22nd. So I literally put a calendar. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I believe in any of this stuff, but I like, my level of petty is I put that as a calendar reminder.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, put, you know, mark August 22nd, see if anything big happens.
Impeachment ball, y'all.
Okay, so let's move on to some related Russia stories that aren't getting as much attention, but we feel like are pertinent to this. So go ahead, Devin.
Right. So the first one was in the Wall Street Journal. They reported that Russian officials were heard discussing Trump associates before his campaign even began, as early as June 2015.
Yeah, so I guess prompted by these Don Jr. emails, intelligence community investigators are taking another look at the conversations captured with Russian government officials discussing Trump associates.
Right. So at the time, no conclusions were drawn, though the number of mentions of Trump's name did raise questions for those who were listening in to the conversations. But now with this additional context, the intelligence community is looking for leads and other answers as to whether the Russian government helped elect Trump.
Yeah. So again, like we said, this is just the beginning.
Yep.
Also, what's interesting, and we've talked about this on the podcast before.
We have.
But there's also a new story about how congressional Democrats are looking at Trump's digital campaign operation, which was overseen by the Kushmeister.
Right.
So they want to know if the campaign helped the Russian government target key states to release fake news stories. And if you remember Hillary Clinton's appearance at that Recode conference, she pretty much said she believed they did.
Right.
She was like, there's just no way that the Russians didn't get American help. And they were like, are you leaning Trump? And she was like, I'm leaning Trump.
Well, yeah. I mean, this was not a blanket release of fake news. It was a precision cyber attack that
right.
target, you know, key swing states and even key swing districts.
Right.
So, you know, you can't do that without data.
Yeah.
There's no way.
And the propaganda campaign began during the Republican primaries and continued once Trump had the nomination. A U.S. intelligence intercept picked up Russians discussing ways to spread news damaging to Clinton in May 2016.
Right.
So again, there's some pieces starting to come together in terms of data that they've already had or intercepts that they've already had.
Right.
So they're also looking into whether or not the campaign's digital arm helped time the release of hacked DNC emails with key moments. Because there was a lot of suspicious timing. Not necessarily, the example I'm thinking of is not with the DNC emails, but Podesta.
A new
Podesta email dump came out within hours of the Access Hollywood tape.
Right. Like, so whenever Trump is having a bad day, boom.
There's an email dump.
Right.
And then the last story is interesting. So the DOJ also recently settled a large Russian money laundering case, and the Democrats want to know why.
Yeah, so this case involved a real estate company owned by Denis Katsiev, who's the son of a powerful Russian government official. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, for a little bit of context here, let me back up. We talked about the Russian lawyer Nikolai Gorkov, who...
On Patreon
a couple months ago.
Yeah.
Back in March, he was set to testify about this case in Moscow when he plummeted from his Moscow apartment and almost died.
Oh, wow.
The day before he was supposed to testify.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and also the lawyer that Donald Trump Jr. met with in June 16 at the Trump Tower that we just talked about.
June 2016.
Yeah. Represents the Katsiv family.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. So this real estate firm that Denis Katsiv owns, Prevazon, which is a Cyprus-based company, by the way, was under investigation by the DOJ for laundering money through New York. And so House Democrats want to know whether that lawyer was involved at any point in the settlement negotiations.
The lawyer that Trump Jr.
met with, yeah, who also represents this family.
Right.
And they've asked Sessions to provide the committee with prosecution files and any other explanatory materials related to the settlement. So basically they want to know if these two things are connected.
Yeah. And as we know, the investigators are also looking into sort of a financial trail,
right,
between Trump and Russia. So they've gotten documents from FinCEN, or they're, yes, working with FinCEN
in order to get those documents.
There's a lot of webs.
Yes.
In the story. Again, this is why Devin has a big ass whiteboard.
Right.
So we're going to keep talking about it, because we definitely don't think this is the end. This is only the beginning. Okay, Devin, so that was a lot. And we say that pretty much every time.
We do.
And it's true every time. So let's get into another thing that's just a lot.
A lot.
So Jesus fucking Christ healthcare.
Yes.
Jesus fucking Christ. Okay, what's happening?
Okay, so the Senate just released their newest version of the healthcare bill and the changes. So the changes are coming, but Medicaid cuts remain. Mm-hmm. So Senate Republicans have, they revised this bill. So the bill keeps two key ACA taxes, which is a 3.8% tax on investment income and a 0.9% payroll tax. And this applies to individuals making more than $200,000 a year, or couples making more than $250,000. It does end the individual mandate. And even with keeping these taxes, it still makes deep cuts to Medicaid.
And from what I understand, too, these they're not really getting rid of, or they still want this to be a big tax cut.
Right. Like, they want it to be a big tax
there's
cut.
There's other ways that they're trying to make that happen.
Absolutely. And then keeping these two taxes is kind of like good press, basically. Mm-hmm. It does provide a $45 billion fund to help combat the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
And there's also something interesting called the Cruz Amendment.
Y'all, Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz.
Can go fuck himself.
He really can. But basically, it allows insurance companies to offer plans outside of the exchanges that are not restricted by mandates if they offer plans that do comply with ACA mandates.
Yeah. And the insurers hate this.
Yes.
Because the way it's set up basically means that the insurance, like, they're not fond of regulations, but they feel like we need some of them,
right,
so that the markets don't go haywire.
Right.
So this Cruz Amendment, they've sort of hypothesized would cause, healthy people to buy like a very skimmed down version,
right,
of health insurance, and sick people to buy sort of the more comprehensive plans, and it would just make everything like bananas.
Right.
And it just wouldn't work.
Right. Matt O'Brien from the Washington Post had a really great quote about this. He said, quote, "Ted Cruz's healthcare plan works great unless you need healthcare."
Yeah. So Ted Cruz is not doing a lot here.
Right. And the Senate Republicans are trying to get this amendment scored by Health and Human Services instead of the CBO because they want to speed up this timeline.
Yeah.
And so since this is a new amendment, it would take the CBO a couple of weeks to score it.
Yeah. I know that, you know, Senator Mike Lee from Utah says he won't vote for the bill without the Cruz amendment. And this is the problem that Republicans have.
Right.
Because they're trying to balance their conservative wing with their quote unquote moderate wing.
Right.
And there are senators who have said that the cuts to Medicaid, so these are sort of the more quote unquote moderate Republicans, they feel like the cuts to Medicaid are too drastic to support the bill, including Senator Portman from Ohio, Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia, Dean Heller from Nevada, Susan Collins from Maine, and Lisa Murkowski from Alaska. And actually, Susan Collins this morning tweeted and she said, I just can't support these deep cuts to Medicaid.
Right.
I just can't support the bill in this form.
And she even said she's willing to work with her colleagues, Republican and Democrat.
Bipartisanship
to get a solution.
It used to be a thing. And also Rand Paul said on Wednesday that he'd vote against it because he says it doesn't come close to a repeal of ACA. So again, these Republicans are having a really hard time balancing between the conservative, like hardline wing, and the moderate, and they're banking on the fact that the moderates will capitulate.
Right.
That's sort of the calculation they're making. But remember, McConnell can only afford to lose two Republicans here.
Right.
So if you already have like someone like Collins and then someone like Rand Paul who are like, hell no.
And on opposite sides of that spectrum.
Then you're in deep water.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, we don't take anything for granted.
No.
I mean, because I feel like Republicans fall in line all the fucking time.
They do. It's what they're good at.
We're going to have an action item. Definitely keep calling. But yeah, you know, I mean, the longer this goes on, the harder it becomes for Republicans to pass it because the public is really, you know, coming together in opposition.
It's true.
80 people were arrested on Capitol Hill on Monday alone for protesting the bill. And actually on Tuesday, McConnell announced that the month-long Senate recess, which was scheduled to begin at the end of July, would be delayed for 2 weeks to allow for more time to work on the healthcare bill and then other agenda items. So this is good and bad, right? Good because it shows that Republicans are having trouble building enough consensus and support for the bill. Bad because it shows that they're motivated to pass it soon.
Right.
Like they don't want to wait till after the recess. They don't want to face their constituents probably.
Right. And so the new CBO score for this bill is supposed to come out next week. And remember that the prior CBO score predicted 22 million people would be uninsured by 2026. And they also estimated it would result in 15 million fewer people being enrolled in Medicaid in a decade.
Yeah. And this is a lot of where the protests are coming from.
Right.
The cuts to Medicaid. Because so many people, especially vulnerable populations, are so reliant on it. And it would, you know, a lot of people have said in no uncertain terms, it would be a death sentence for them.
Right.
This bill is a death sentence.
It is a death sentence from the death party.
From the death party.
So next, we are going to introduce our interviewee for today, Tracy Chow. She is an entrepreneur, software engineer, and diversity advocate. She's part of the founding team at Project Include, a group that's working to accelerate diversity and inclusion solutions in the tech industry. From 2011 to 2016, Tracy was an engineer and tech lead at Pinterest, where she made a name for herself for her technical work as well as for her public push toward industry-wide diversity data disclosures. She was named Forbes' Tech 30 Under 30 in 2014 and has been profiled in Vogue, Wired, The Atlantic, and other outlets for her advocacy. We're excited to get to chat with her today on Hellbent. So welcome, Tracy. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
Tracy, first off, I noticed that you graduated from Stanford, and I'm a Cal grad. You know, rival schools. So do you feel like we can get through this interview like without fisticuffs?
We'll
I went to Davis. I'm not in this fight.
Yeah. but really, we don't want to talk about, you know, alma mater rivalries. We want to talk about you, your work, mm-hmm. and sort of how tech intersects with politics, because there's been a lot of that these days. But first of all, we'd love to hear how Project Include came about and what the specific goals of the group are.
Yeah, so Project Include is a group of 8 of us women in tech that got together last year. And we wanted to start pushing forward more on solutions for tech diversity and inclusion. The origin of the group, as it came about, is Ellen Pao, and a few of us have been just talking about state of diversity and inclusion industry, acknowledging that there's been a lot of discussion, but we weren't seeing as much of a push towards solutions. So more like people lamenting the lack of diversity, but not making a lot of progress. And we were also seeing that people would come to us in one-offs and ask what to do. So there's starting to be more of this appetite for the right thing to do, but people didn't know how they could actually put their commitment into action. And so we got together, eight of us, and wanted to just write down everything that we knew that was kind of known to be best practice at the time. So to start to compile this handbook of resources and recommendations for tech startups. And we didn't have too much of a intention beyond that, but besides that first, like, let's put down a handbook. And because it was pretty well received, a lot of people were excited to see this compendium of resources and some more guidance around how to approach diversity and inclusion. There was kind of a push for more programmatic content. And so from there, we ended up doing a program called Startup Include, where we selected a group of about 10 startups, which had executive level support towards making changes on diversity and inclusion. So this cohort of companies worked together. We'd also study their data, do surveys with them, and help to put into practice some of the recommendations. And from there, we've actually now formally incorporated as a nonprofit. Nice. And actually have staff that's helping us run things day-to-day operationally.
Wow.
And we're really excited to keep pushing forward on that and engage in the conversation around diversity and inclusion. One other really big thing for us that all got together originally for Project Include is that we wanted to be a little bit more unified in our efforts. So all of us individually had been in various conversations with people, like sometimes press, sometimes within organizations, about diversity and inclusion. And we felt like it would be more powerful if we were actually coordinating our efforts and talking about what was most important, and also being able to bounce ideas off of each other and have sometimes difficult conversations within our group about how to push forward as a movement.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you saw conversations happening and you didn't see as much action. So you're really like pushing toward action, which I think is great. Cause I've definitely noticed that in tech, like there seems to be a lot of conversations, but you look at the numbers, which we're going to get into, and you're seeing maybe plateaus or slow, but steady upticks. And that kind of relates to what you said in your Vogue profile from a few years back. So you talked about, and I'm paraphrasing, these are not Tracy's words, but sort of how data-obsessed tech is in terms of solving product problems, but how the data on the diversity side, at least, you know, back in 2014 when you were talking to Vogue, was sparse at best. And if you don't have good data, it's hard to both properly address and solve, like, inclusion issues. So in what ways since then has the tech industry improved, and where do companies still fall short, do you think?
So we've gotten a lot better about having some level of diversity data. And so now it's relatively common for tech companies to release their diversity stats on an annual cadence. So breakdowns of gender and race for technical, non-technical teams, leadership, et cetera. So we're now starting to see some sort of baseline, which is good. And it's that typical adage of what you don't measure, you can't manage. So having that data is at least some acknowledgement that is something that we are paying attention to. And we do now have somewhat of a baseline to understand if efforts are actually moving things in the right direction or not, or moving them at all. In the last few years, that we've also seen that just having the data out there isn't quite enough. And this goes back a little bit to the earlier point, but why Project Include was started was that even though there was some acknowledgement of the problem, there hasn't been as much success in driving towards solutions. I think some of that is just because people have underestimated the problem and felt like, oh, if we just start tracking it, then we'll definitely trend in the right direction. but it takes a lot more concerted effort than that. And one thing that's a little bit funny about the tech industry is it does try to be very innovative and define the future, but sometimes with this attitude of disregarding everything in the past.
Right.
So there's actually been decades of research around diversity and inclusion, in academic literature, also empirical studies on industry. There's a lot of research out there and best practice. I think the tech industry has been willfully ignorant of it.
Yes.
One of my Project Include teammates, Frida K. Poor Klein, she's been working on this for decades with the tech industry.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, because so, it's a relatively young industry.
Right. But it's an old problem, though.
But it's been around for longer, I think, than people think. It's just boomed, right, especially in the last decade or so.
Yeah, and there's also booms and busts. Right. So the late 90s were kind of boom, and then
right,
came crashing down, and we're in another boom. So there's been ups and downs. I think there's a lot more we can learn from the past than we often give the past credit for,
right,
in the tech industry. And so I think in the last couple of years, seeing the lack of progress in moving these diversity and inclusion numbers up, people are starting to recognize that the issues are more deep-seated and fundamental, and there's starting to be a little bit more attention paid to what the true underlying problems are and how deep-seated the fixes will also have to be.
Right.
Yeah, when I talk about it with friends, I sort of make a joke, like, the tech industry is all about disrupting things except, like, themselves. Like, you almost, yes, have to, like, disrupt yourself to,
right,
like, to unpack all your, you know, internalized biases.
Right.
So I think the work you're doing is really important.
Yeah. So, on this vein of, like, solutions, Susan Fowler wrote a blog post in February about her time at Uber, and it went, like, mega viral, and it seemingly might lead to meaningful change across the industry. So why do you think this particular post sparked this kind of potential tipping point in tech? Like, what's different right now?
I'm not sure I would say that this is necessarily a tipping point. I think we've had these flashpoints in the past where people thought that sea changes were coming. I would think, like, Ellen Pao's case, for example, a few years ago was pretty big. There's a lot of attention on that. But in the aftermath of that case, like, not much really changed. I think Susan Fowler's blog post got a lot of attention because it was this perfect storm. People wanted to hate on Uber already.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there had already been that Delete Uber campaign,
right,
in light of the taxi
ban.
And, like, yeah, the travel ban and all that. And at least within the Valley, like, there's an open secret that Uber's work environment was pretty terrible.
Right.
There'd already been people talking about how they refused to work at Uber, and some people sharing screenshots of emails they sent in reply to Uber recruiters saying, I would never work at your company. Because,
yeah, I think I saw some of those.
Yeah. So people already wanted to hate Uber, and Susan's blog post was very, very well written, and I think she got everything just right. The tone she struck was perfect. It was not angry, which is something that often comes to hurt in these conversations, because there's the tone policing that goes on, or it plays into these stereotypes of women being too emotional, and then they get discredited. So she took this kind of, like,
measured sort of
tone. Yeah,
yeah,
so it was a very strange year, which,
yeah,
I find a strange way to put it.
Yeah.
But it had that perfect level of detachment and lack,
right,
of emotion, which was critical for it to be accepted. She didn't do anything wrong. So she had a perfect paper trail. She never engaged in anything that was more controversial. So she had comported herself perfectly. She had the documentation. She wrote the piece very well. I think there may be something to the fact that she is a white woman,
right,
and very presentable. She was established enough in her career. She had just written a book. She also had her next job already, so she was already working at Stripe, which has a good engineering reputation, so people wouldn't discredit her based on
technical skills.
So everything was just right, and I think that helped to get it more traction.
Right.
But I'm not convinced necessarily that we've hit that tipping point yet. I think there are these moments where there's suddenly a lot of press attention, but it doesn't necessarily lead to long-lasting change.
Right.
I'm cautiously optimistic that we could turn this moment into something more powerful, but I don't think by default it will.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you think, like, the discrimination is just as bad in other industries. So this lack of diversity, and you know, if so, or is it particularly bad in tech, or is it kind of comparable to other industries? And why do you think that might be?
I think it's worse in tech than we might expect. And it feels worse because tech also tries to claim that it's meritocratic.
Right.
Right.
I think in other industries, there's no pretense.
Right.
Or there's less pretense that it's very fair.
Right.
I guess in other industries, there may just be open sexism. And in fact, it pretends to not be sexist.
Right.
Right. Or discriminatory in other ways, it actually is.
It masks itself in this meritocracy that is a complete myth.
Right.
If you know anything about biases and oppression.
Yeah. And there is also research that says that organizations that believe themselves to be meritocratic are actually less so.
Yes.
Right.
Because they don't have that bias.
They miss it.
Yeah. It's playing out large across the industry because industry believes itself to be meritocratic or has up until recently, and I think some of that sentiment may be shifting now that it's not so meritocratic, but I think there is still kind of that flavor. I think because so much of tech wants to discard the past, sometimes it also discards known best practices around, say, HR and management.
Right.
For example, early on at Google, they didn't really believe in management, so it was very, very flat for a long time and got pretty chaotic before they realized that actually you probably do want managers.
Yeah.
And I've heard stories of friends at startups that don't have HR departments.
Yeah.
They just don't have them.
And that's not uncommon,
right.
I don't think.
Or, you know, they don't even have HR policies.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily that HR is going to be a solution to all your problems or even most of them, but there are some basic things having HR is good for.
right, absolutely.
So I think there's a little bit of this ethos of wanting to do everything from first principles or reinvent everything and like rediscover and be innovative in all aspects of company building, not necessarily just in the products, but also in how the organizations are run, that has led to us having to relearn a lot of hard lessons that we should have already been able to learn from others' experience.
Yeah, they're just like, it seems like it's just reproducing old... Oh.
Uh-oh.
Looks like we lost her.
Yeah.
Oh. There you are. No worries. Back. You're back.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like it's reproducing old systems in just different ways.
Right.
And sort of speaking from personal experience for you, what are some of your more egregious but also more subtle experiences of discrimination and perhaps harassment as an Asian woman in tech?
I've been very fortunate. I don't think I've had the sorts of egregious harassment or discrimination that many people I know have faced. I've heard all sorts of things like, oh, I thought women didn't care about their careers. I thought they only cared about having babies. Or things like, oh, I just didn't think you'd be a very good coder because usually physical attractiveness and technical ability are inversely correlated.
I've heard that one so many times. I don't understand how that
keeps happening.
Yeah, and that sort of thing is like bad in so many ways. Like that, I think that was an attempted neg.
Right.
So it was like the mixing up of personal and professional, mm-hmm. as if like putting someone down professionally will increase your romantic prospects with somebody.
Right.
I, of course.
You're like, that's not working for me.
Yeah.
Like in any aspect.
I would love to know like the logic chain that gets you there.
Don't even try.
Yeah. And I think the more subtle things would be like in the workplace, and it's very hard to pinpoint exactly, but feeling like people don't trust me nearly as much to get my job done well, and those lower expectations also have an impact on my ability to perform. So it's like if you reference the academic literature around stereotype threat and the sorts of expectations that are set for categories of people and how they tend to perform to those, whether those are high or low. Operating in an environment where you're expected to be worse, it may actually become somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I used to find myself very frustrated that I was thinking about these things all the time, feeling like I was being discounted for who I was and about things like I couldn't change and that were completely unfair. And then I would get mad at myself for wasting so many mental cycles thinking about it.
Right.
Instead of thinking about my engineering work. And then I was just all this like this like meta worrying.
Right. Yeah.
And then being angry is like, no, I should be focusing on my work to be better so I can dispel these stereotypes. But why am I still thinking about the fact that I need to do this?
Yeah.
A bit of that.
Yeah. The additional like emotional burden mm-hmm. and the guilt and all of that is definitely
a thing.
Yeah.
I think we also want to switch gears to politics as it intersects with tech. So, you know, with Russia hacking our election and all the news that's just come out in this recent cycle, this weaponizing fake news through sites like Facebook, there's a big question as to what tech leaders' role should be in terms of safeguarding our democracy. Do you think that tech companies have a social responsibility to resource against this goal? And if so, what steps do you think someone like Mark Zuckerberg should take to do so?
Absolutely. I think tech companies have moral responsibility. We, as a tech industry, are fundamentally changing the way society operates in so many ways, and to not acknowledge that there are ramifications for changing the way that people communicate or see news feels unethical. So I think it's really important that just like at the outset that we acknowledge that there is that power. It's not necessarily clear in all cases what the right thing to do is. And I think it's important that we at least have these discussions around what are the moral obligations and what should be done in various cases. I think there are interesting philosophical debates that can be had around these things. So just let's take one example. Like if we now view Facebook as the way that most people get their news, as opposed to cable networks or like the newspapers, now there's sort of this editorial responsibility, but what is the goal? Do we want people to be well read about the world? How do we determine what is more important to know about? Is it more important to know about conflict and war, or is it more important to know about positive things? Is it important that people are engaged in their local communities? Even if we acknowledge that there is an editorial responsibility of such platforms, like how that editorial should bias.
Right.
Right.
Clear. In the past, it used to be, I guess, it was more transparent. Like, so if you would go look at different newspapers, you would know that they had slightly different reputation or slightly different editorial slants. It's just not very clear at all when you have platforms like Facebook or Twitter, and they have their algorithms that surface what you're most likely to be interested in or what's trending. It's not clear, transparent at all, how those determinations are being made or what sort of criteria are being used. So I think it's important that we at least acknowledge that that is a thing.
Yeah.
And there is some responsibility of these platforms in that space, and just to be more transparent about what they're attempting to do, right. I think would be helpful.
It's a big question.
Yeah.
We don't expect you to solve it. It's just something interesting to think about because,
right.
You know, there's been wide speculation that Zuckerberg might run for president. I mean, he's like making random road trips and, you know, Iowa and stuff like that. Like, just so people are like, are you running for president? So I'm curious, in your opinion, do you think Zuckerberg should run? And more broadly, do you think it's a good idea for tech leaders and or those without public service experience to hold the highest office in the land? And this is your personal opinion.
Right.
I think there should be more people with deep understanding of technology and science in office. I don't know that that necessarily should be the case for the highest office in the land.
Right.
If it means that they don't have experience operating in that realm.
Like maybe start at like a state or local
right.
level first and like work your way up is what you're thinking instead of going straight to the presidency.
Right.
Yeah. Like I think it's important to acknowledge that there are different domains of expertise.
Yeah. Right. I was going to say like, you know, I think it's great to lend your expertise, but know your limitations. Like, you can be a leader in the tech industry, but that might not translate well.
Right. Or at least, like, acknowledging that there are different ways that systems operate.
Right.
And that just taking the tech mindset and applying it blindly to another arena may not work.
Right.
There's just different sets of considerations, different ways in which things get done. Mm-hmm. So I think it's hubristic for tech leaders to just think they can run for office. Not to say that I think Zuck wants to run. I'm not convinced that he does. I think so my read on it is that he wants to understand more of what's happening in the country, as many of us do, and understand how the platform that he has built with Facebook may influence all these different people. I actually think it's more powerful for him to be running Facebook than
being president. Yeah.
Because Facebook is a global platform. Like, a very large percentage of the world is on Facebook.
Right. And
the internet is this largely borderless domain, which is still very much like almost like cowboy territory. There's not a lot of law or policing. These platforms get to define their own policies around what is acceptable or not. That is a very interesting space to be in.
And you're saying he can really shape that.
Yes.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and then, but there are other tech leaders like LinkedIn's Reid Hoffman and Zynga's Mark Pincus who are trying to throw their hats into the ring, in a sense, with their newly announced group, Win the Future, or WTF for short. and they've, you know, talked about recruiting political outsiders, voting for platform planks on Twitter, and they've been putting up billboards. So what's...
Or they want to put up...
They want to put up billboards, right. What's your response to this new initiative, and do you think that they're on the right track?
I don't know enough about their specific initiative to comment on it. I do think there's a lot of opportunity right now for new groups to rise up and try to engage with our democracy in different ways. So it feels like we're in this phase of letting 1,000 flowers bloom and see what different organizations might be effective. Yeah. And I do like the idea that people who in the past may not have been as politically engaged or civically engaged are interested. I personally don't have enough of an understanding of the whole ecosystem to know which things will be the most effective. And I think we'll just see over time which initiatives do get more traction. I think it is important that these different groups work together and coordinate, and instead of fracturing the energy to like bring it together and like supercharge it.
Yeah.
So one group that I've been involved with, I helped to co-found the Arena. So we started post-election in November of 2016. And our initial idea was just getting people together around the idea of running for office.
Oh, cool.
And on the left, the general left progressive side of things, there's been more of a distaste for political office, and not as many people who would be really great in positions of setting policy haven't been interested in doing that. And so where we came out on that, we've organized a couple of summits now, and we've seen our place in the ecosystem is actually just bringing people together, bringing organizations together, candidates, and helping to foster that connective tissue within the ecosystem. Sometimes there are people who are working on very similar things and they would do better to actually join forces. Other cases, when they can talk about what they're doing, they can understand how they can partner more effectively or leverage each other's strengths. And then also connect people to the organizations that want to help them. I think getting more coordinated as a political movement will be helpful.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so to close out our interviews, we always like to do like a mini gratitude check with our guests, because we do one every episode, and we feel like it's important to sort of take stock of like the good things that are happening both personally and in the larger world amidst such trying times, to put it mildly. So what's something that you're grateful for right now?
Big or small, silly or...
Yeah, it could really be anything. I mean, we've had people say, you know, Netflix streaming. I mean, that's, you know...
Which I am grateful
for. We're grateful for.
Yeah. It's kind of funny you bring this up. So one thing I've been trying to do this year is just to be more grateful. So once in a while, I will think about three things in my day that have made me feel gratitude. Things I find myself often like putting in my top three are like people, like good people around me, good people I get to meet and get to learn from, just life and like, being healthy, being able to go to the gym and move around. I've been really fortunate recently to be able to travel for some conferences and to experience different cities and be exposed to different cultures. Like, that's phenomenal. It's good to be reminded of all the beauty and diversity that there is in the world.
That's lovely.
I love that.
Yeah, we really love that. Just like taking stock of all like the little things, little and big things that are good.
Right. Well, thank you to Tracy Chow for joining us today on Hellbent. You can follow her on Twitter at Tricotora and follow Project Include at Project Include. And I know you also mentioned Arena. So where can we find that project?
Yeah, Arena is on Twitter as Arena Summit.
Great.
So, yes.
Awesome. Well, thank you for chatting with us today, Tracy. We really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for having me. It's lovely to chat.
So that was an amazing interview.
We say that every week.
We do, but she was so smart and eloquent.
Yeah, we really get to talk to a lot of really awesome people, and I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, me too. It's the best part of this
job. And I loved her gratitude check.
I did too.
I always love to hear different guests' gratitude check.
Yeah, I think it might be my favorite part of these interviews.
Yeah.
Okay, Sarah, so what are you grateful for today?
Yeah, so now we're getting into our own gratitude check. So the first thing I'm grateful for is Andy Murray. He's a tennis player extraordinaire and corrector of casual sexism. So he had just lost to Sam Querrey in the quarterfinals of Wimbledon when a reporter asked him about his thoughts on Querrey being the, quote, the first American to reach a major semifinal since 2009. But Murray interrupted this guy and said, the first male player.
Right.
Remember, Serena motherfucking Williams alone, just her, has won more than 10 major titles since 2009.
Yeah.
That's just 2009. Like, that's just since 2009, and that there's like plenty more American women in tennis who have achieved a similar feat or semifinal feat at least in major tournaments.
Yeah.
So this was a bit of deja vu because he had recently corrected a BBC commentator during the 2016 Olympics who said Murray was the first person to ever win two Olympic gold medals in tennis, to which Murray said, I think Venus and Serena have won about four each.
Oh, man. He is like...
He's on fire.
Fire.
Well, yeah. And he does have a history of supporting women in tennis. In 2014, he became the first high-profile player to hire a female coach when he took on Amélie Mauresmo, who's a two-time Grand Slam champion. And then earlier this week, The Guardian dubbed Murray, quote, the feminist tennis needs, after he had criticized Wimbledon officials for giving precedent to men's matches on center court.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was cute because Judy Murray, Andy's mother, and she's also a tennis coach, tweeted a quote of the exchange with a comment, that's my boy. And then it was it had a little heart emoji.
That's so cute.
Yeah, so it might seem like a small thing, but I feel like it's so important.
It is.
Women are discounted across society in both blatant and subtle ways, like sort of illustrated here. And Murray is using his position of privilege to help correct that.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we ask men to do. And I think it's good to highlight positive examples of that.
I agree. And he really,
he's committed to it.
He's committed to it.
Yeah,
and that's great.
Hats off to Andy Murray. The second thing I'm grateful for is Bunny Berson. You might not have heard of her, but you might have heard of the story. She's an artist who employed unused election night confetti for a piece of art. So it's displayed 24 hours a day in her current St. Louis gallery exhibition front window. And her work of art has the words, "And Still I Rise," which is a reference to Maya Angelou's famous book of poetry. And the iridescent confetti floats around in a glass box like a snow globe. So this is the unused confetti from that was supposed to be shot off from a cannon.
Right.
the Javits Center.
Right.
So she has a video of this work of art on her Instagram, which is at Bunny Burson Studio, with the a cappella song from the Women's March that went viral, I Can't Keep Quiet. And it honestly gives me chills. I know. Like, it it's makes beautiful. Me so sad and happy at the same time.
I know. It's really beautiful. And I love that it's Still I Rise because...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels appropriate.
It does.
Yeah, and it's funny because the tracking down of this unused confetti was apparently really hard. She made calls to Arkansas, Boston, New York, Connecticut, Illinois, and D.C. And a lot of people had warned her, like, she probably wouldn't find it.
Right.
But ultimately, her quest was successful. So she's a longtime Clinton devotee. She was the executive director of the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities under Bill Clinton, his administration. And then in the aftermath of the 2016 election, she said she hopes her art will motivate women to run for office in 2018.
Yeah.
And she had a really great quote. She said, quote, "I was among her supporters at the Javits Center, waiting for the symbolic shattering of the glass ceiling and the shard-like confetti to fall down on us." So this is like that iridescent confetti.
Right.
She said, "We left the Javits Center at 2 a.m. with profound emptiness. I wanted to fill that emptiness with hope by giving voice to my feelings that even in defeat, Hillary's confetti could be used to inspire the next generation of little girls and young women to dream big and to act on their dreams."
That's beautiful.
Which I really love.
I just got chills.
I know.
I love that.
So we'll link to that in the show notes. You can see that story there. Finally, the last thing I'm grateful for is a little bit of a Twitter, like, politics Twitter deep cut.
Oh.
Or not deep cut, but you have to be sort of, like, like, really in politics Twitter to understand this. So I made some sort of, like, neoliberal all-star team list.
Okay, I am so jealous of this whole situation. I want to know, like, what I need to do to get on this list immediately.
Yeah, and they didn't intend it to be a neoliberal
all-star list. I know.
But there was some Bernie bro who put it out and put me on it. So for context, this random dude bro dedicated time out of his day to make this, like, ridiculous graphic with 30 people's Twitter avatars and handles, including my own, which he tweeted out with, quote, "These are the hashtag corporate shills out to smear Senator Sanders and derail the progressive movement. Divisive protectors of the 1%. Hashtag I will never trust."
I seriously need to be on this list.
First of all, I didn't know I had that much power.
Right.
Like, I feel a little bit like...
Yeah, a little drunk with power.
A little drunk with power here.
I get that.
Second of all, my bank account begs to differ about this 1% characterization. I'm just going to put that out there. Yeah. Like, I don't even have a lake house in Vermont.
Oh. You don't? I have 3.
I know. Like Bernie.
Like Bernie.
Well, he has 3 homes. One lake house.
That's fair.
Also, like, if you're going to put me on a list or, like, in the same breath as Joy Reid, like, that's exactly where I want
you to be. Living your best life.
But yeah, like, what started off as something super creepy, and let's be real, this is creepy no matter what.
It's a little creepy.
But it turned into one of the most unexpectedly hilarious and amazing things to ever happen to me on Twitter.com. Everyone on the list was, like, bantering about it all day and saying, like, the funniest shit. And a lot of our, a lot of my own personal favorite Twitter follows are on there. So it felt like, you know, good company.
Yeah.
Also, we all gained a bunch of, like, new followers.
Yeah.
Like, I think I picked up, like, 1,500 in just 24 hours, which is a big increase.
That's a lot, yeah.
So it really backfired in, like, the most spectacular way. Like, it was truly the most Man Bun Ken thing ever.
It was really Man Bun Kenny.
Man Bun Kenny. It was great. Anyway, that's what I'm grateful for today. Okay. Devin, what are you grateful for?
Okay, so first, I am grateful for Cards Against Humanity.
Yeah.
So this is one of my favorite games ever. Do not play it with your parents, grandparents, children, or uptight conservative siblings. But basically, this company released a new version just for women. It's exactly the same as the game before, with exactly the same cards. It's in a pink box, though. So it's for girls. It costs $5 more than the standard edition of the game, which retails for $25. So it's a $30 game, exactly the same, but you get the pink box.
Right.
So they're kind of lampooning this so-called pink tax, where women are asked to pay more for, you know, the female versions of everyday items, like toothbrushes and shampoo and deodorant.
Yeah, the quote-unquote, like, female version.
Female version, yeah. Which is exactly the same. They also committed to giving the profits from the Cards Against Humanity for her addition to Emily's list, which is just extra awesome.
Love that.
Yeah. The community director, Jen Bain, said, "We decided that, hey, it's 2017. It's time for women to have a spot at the table." And nevertheless, she persisted. "That's why we made Cards Against Humanity for her. It's trendy, stylish, and easy to understand. And it's pink." So they also have a weed pack and a period pack of extra cards for the game for $5 each. And Cards Against Humanity has this ridiculous tradition of making money doing nothing. Yeah, in 2015, they made over $70,000 by selling nothing at $5. They literally said, "We will not send you anything for $5.
They're just donations.
Yeah. And in 2016, Cards Against Humanity got $100,000 in donations to dig a hole in the middle of nowhere for absolutely no reason, which my husband contributed to.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I could be totally talking out of my ass, but weren't they also the ones that, like, sold bags of poop or something?
Yes, I have two of them. So Devin, in my house.
Devin is one of those fools.
I am one of those fools, yeah. So that was silly.
I love that.
Something less silly is Democrats in Oklahoma.
Local politics is sexy.
Local politics is sexy. So two Democratic candidates pulled off surprise wins in two state house races in Oklahoma. So Michael Brooks Jimenez, a local immigration attorney, was elected as a new state senator for District 44. And Tulsa's House District 75, Karen Gaddis, who's a retired school teacher, won a seat that had been Republican for over two decades.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing. So according to Flippable, these two districts went Republican by 10 and 19 points, respectively, the last time they were contested.
Yeah, I actually don't know which one is which.
Oh, fair.
Yeah, fair. But they were big. They were big margins.
Yeah, big pickups. And just for some added context, so in May, the GOP won a Trump plus 50 state House seat in Oklahoma by plus two.
Holy shit.
Plus two.
Wow.
That's
so it
nothing.
Was plus 50 in November 2016.
Right.
And May 2017, right. It was only plus two.
Plus two. That's a 48-point swing.
Wow.
Yeah. Those are...
That's bananas.
It's bananas. So these wins, to kind of couch this a little bit, they were owed in part to, like, scandal that has just gripped the Republican Party in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
There was a number of state officials who've been forced to resign because of sexual harassment claims. And in one instance, child prostitution.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, basically, dickwad's gonna dickwad.
Yeah.
And that's a part of why Democrats were able to pick up these seats. There's also an ongoing budget crisis. And that's led to, like, four-day weeks at many Oklahoma schools.
Oh, I remember seeing that story.
Yeah. And so, basically, no one's fucking happy with Republican leadership. But it does underscore this, like, growing backlash against the GOP.
Yeah.
And it's really elevated Democrats in various contests across the country. I mean, we saw it with, you know, Quist and Ossoff.
Yeah.
You know, of the 29 special elections that have taken place, four seats, all of them state-based, have been flipped from Republican to Democrat. And these contests have seen an average voter swing of 11 percentage points towards Democratic candidates compared to the 2016 cycle.
Oh, wow.
Which basically means margins matter. We've talked about this before. Even though Ossoff didn't win, the fact that it was such a close race says a lot about the wave coming.
There's a reason why those seats were special elections.
Right.
Part of it is because the Trump administration picked people who they felt like were in very safe Republican districts. And there's so many more districts across the country that are not as safe, that are much more vulnerable.
And when we're looking at 48-point swings, 11-point swings, 19-point swings, those are big.
Yeah.
Those are big margins.
Yeah.
So that matters. And then the final thing that I'm grateful for is a woman named Madeline Parker and the CEO of the company she works for, Ben Congleton.
Congleton.
Mm-hmm. I always want to say the first thing that comes to my mind, and I'm like, it can't be that. But basically, Parker sent an email to her team letting them know that she was taking 2 days off for her mental health. And she got a really great response from her CEO. Congleton said, quote, "I just wanted to personally thank you for sending emails like this. Every time you do, I use it as a reminder of the importance of using sick days for mental health. I can't believe this isn't standard practice at all organizations. You are an example to us all and help cut through the stigma so we can all bring our whole selves to work." And that's just really lovely.
Yeah, I love that.
I just love that. And the CEO was so stunned by this outpouring of support that he wrote about it on Medium.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I wasn't expecting the exposure, but I am so glad that I was able to have such a positive impact on so many people. When an athlete is injured, they sit on the bench and recover. Let's get rid of the idea that somehow the brain is different.
Totally.
Yeah. And as someone who suffers from, you know, mental illness and you know, really those mental health days can make such a big difference between showing up and doing your work and just burning out completely.
Yeah. And it's really inspiring to see someone be so open about it.
Right.
Like this woman, Madeline Parker.
Right.
And she's setting an example for other people and she's giving other people tacit permission to do so as well.
Right. All right, Sarah. So it's the end of the week. Let's keep the good times rolling.
Yes.
And do our Maxine Waters update and our Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. So what has the Honorable Miss Waters been up to?
Oh, yeah. Queen Maxine's been busy this week.
Yes, she has.
So first of all, in her Financial Services Committee work, she said in a hearing, quote, let's look at what Trump has actually done when it comes to our economy. None of it is good. And of course, she continued to spit straight fire when it came to Russia bullshit. I remember she didn't tweet about Trump Jr.'s stuff right away. She waited hours. I was like, why hasn't Maxine tweeted yet? Like, I was waiting with bated breath, and she delivered.
It was worth waiting for.
Yeah. In a series of tweets responding to this Trump Jr. story, Maxine said, quote, don't let Trump Jr. off the hook. Emails show his willingness to get info from Russia to influence the election. He is in a long line of liars. Liars was in all caps. And then she said, quote, at this point, the New York Times could release Trump leaving a voice message thanking Putin for his services, and the GOP would still say, nothing burger.
I love that she used nothing burger.
I know.
And she used it correctly, which I've never done successfully.
She's so great. She also went on MSNBC and said, quote, I think we're getting played. We're getting played by our president, and certainly we're getting played by Putin. And she also said, I'm questioning the patriotism of Republicans who are allowing this president to side with Putin. I'm like, hard agree. What the fuck are you guys doing?
And why do we keep saying that GOP is so patriotic? Like, fuck you.
I know. It's so strange. Like, Trump has this quote unquote America first message, but he's literally putting Russia first.
I know. Like, you know, when we were designing the local politics as sexy merch and you're like, the flag's kind of Trumpy. I'm like, no.
Yeah.
No, they do not get the flag.
That reminds me of what Lauren Duca said on 4th of July. She was like, conservatives aren't the ones who own patriotism. Like,
no.
I'm a feminist and I care about this country and I'm fighting for it.
Yeah, a lot.
I know. We have, like, even in our, like, even seeps into our own sort of minds.
Absolutely.
Which is true. She also threw some seriously masterful shade on healthcare and impeachment, like, simultaneously.
That's
it
so
was
good.
Beautiful. She said, quote, I hear the Senate is staying in session to repeal healthcare. That should give the House enough time to get ready for impeachment.
Girl.
I love her.
Teach me your shade ways.
I know.
So good.
She's so great. Okay, so let's move on to the Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. And as, you know, it's worth repeating, Maxine really gets first place.
I mean, she won.
So this is really like a second place award.
Right.
And then we also have some honorable mentions.
Right.
So who's our first honorable mention?
So our first honorable mention is the Polish First Lady.
Yes.
Who expertly swerved away from Donald Trump because she didn't want to shake his hand. Which, girl, hard agree.
I go on Twitter and find the GIF.
It's so good. Because
it's beautiful.
She just, it's not so seamless. It's so seamless. It's not subtle,
but it is seamless. Like the moment, it's not subtle, but it is seamless.
Yeah.
You see that moment on Trump's face where he like realizes that she's doing it. Like, that's also pretty subtle.
It was so great.
The second honorable mention is a bit of a posthumous honorable mention because this woman recently died. And I don't even know if I'm saying posthumous.
I went on
like pronunciation, so I was like posthumous.
That's amazing.
So let us know, Hellions, if I pronounce that right. But her name is Sheila Michaels. So I'd surprisingly never heard of her before, but she introduced the honorific Miss, so MS period, into common parlance, which seems like a small thing, but it was quite the feminist accomplishment.
It really is.
Yeah. She didn't coin the term itself, but she worked quietly with little initial support from the women's movement to usher it back into being after a decades long slumber. And that's a process she later described as, quote, a timid 8-year crusade.
Yeah.
She had long dreamed of finding an honorific to fill a gap in the English lexicon. So a term for women that, like Mr., did not trumpet its subject's marital status.
No, I think it's great because Miss is for little girls. Miss is if you're married. So
what do you do?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so she said, quote, "There was no place for me. No one wanted to claim me, and I didn't want to be owned. I didn't belong to my father, and I didn't want to belong to a husband, someone who could tell me what to do." And I love the way that the New York Times characterized her impact in their obit of her. They said, quote, "Miss Michaels leaves a legacy both minute and momentous. Two consonants and a small dot. Three characters that forever changed English discourse."
It's beautiful.
Which I loved.
I love.
So posthumous honorary mention for Sheila Michaels.
Yes.
So who are our winners this week?
We have two.
We have men. Men can win this award.
They can.
Yeah.
We're not against
it. They have to be extraordinary.
Right. And these two...
Well, especially white men have to be extra extraordinary.
Right. Which we're about to break it down.
Yeah.
So it's Al Green and Brad Sherman, who is my representative.
She's been, like, really jealous of all, like, the Ted Lieu fire.
I have.
Like, my rep. And
yeah.
She's, like, she actually put on the outline, like, she's like, "Brad Sherman is as cool as Ted Lieu."
And she's like, lies. And I was like, you know what? Brad Sherman looks like your dad's friend who's an accountant, but now he's your dad's friend who's an accountant who plays sweet jazz flute on Thursday nights at the Palladino. I'm just saying.
He's totally that guy.
That's he's totally
like,
that guy.
He's like in a secret band that no one knows about. And then like you go to the, like the club.
And you're like, who
and you're
heard
like, what?
You?
I didn't know you played sweet whatever.
Jazz flute.
Yeah. So basically, they win this award because Sherman and Al Green introduced articles of impeachment.
Right.
So the impeachment papers accuse, quote, Trump of obstructing justice by firing former FBI Director James Comey over an investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. And Green said, "I don't see this as a long shot or a sure shot. I see this as the right thing to do. I've always felt that if I'm doing the right thing, my conscience is clear, and I think history will vindicate me regardless of how the House votes."
Yeah. And then Sherman said in a partial statement, "This is the first step on a very long road."
Right.
So they both know that this isn't necessarily something...
This isn't going to happen right away.
Right. But they're just saying that this is something we need to put out there. So far, Green and Sherman are the only sponsors of the impeachment resolution. While no other representatives have, you know... stepped up to sponsor this bill, they have been calling for impeachment, but there's been no real action until this resolution was filed.
Yeah.
So Green has faced death threats and racial slurs for his support of the impeachment resolution.
Oh, right. That was disgusting.
Which is disgusting. But he said, quote, "This is not about the right or the left. It's not about Democrats. It's about democracy. It's not about Republicans. It's about the Republic."
Yes.
It's so true. And then Sherman is an 11-term Democrat and seems to be out of fucks to give.
Yes.
Like, completely.
He's ready to play that gig at the club.
Oh, totally.
Make it a full-time thing.
Right. He's like, I can play jazz flute. Like, I'm not worried.
But first I gotta impeach
the dickwad. And then we're gonna go back to the jazz flute.
Yeah.
So, you know, this move has kind of put him at odds with the Democratic leaders in the House.
Right.
Because they don't want to basically...
They're still feeling gun-shy.
They want to focus on, you know, the economy and healthcare and Russia, which are all great things to focus on. But Brad fucking Sherman and Al fucking Green were like, we can walk and chew gum, friends.
Yeah.
Like, we'll do it all.
Come on.
And then Sherman actually did tell Pelosi that he wouldn't call for a floor vote until they consulted with the Democratic caucus. They're not trying to, like, be, you know...
They have a realistic
idea.
Sense,
right.
But they're like, we're going to move forward and start the process.
Right. And in a statement, Sherman said he and Green will push the Judiciary Committee to hold hearings on the matter. He added that he hopes introducing articles of impeachment would, quote, inspire an intervention in the White House. He called his move the first step on a very long road. And he believed that the Republicans would join the effort many, many months from now if Trump's incompetence continues. He also said that he worked with Pence in Congress for years. And he's like, I've never agreed with him on anything in my whole life. And I never thought I would be in a position to put him in the presidency. But here we are. But the translation in all this was, yeah, we're definitely out of fucks to give.
Yeah, because fuck this. Like, they're seeing what's happening.
Right. Up like, close and personal.
Like, we can't proceed like everything's normal.
Right.
And there's this big question of, is, like, all this Russia stuff going to be the thing that leads Trump to impeachment?
Right.
Or is it going to more be, like, a potential failure of the healthcare bill?
Right.
That causes Republicans to be like...
We're turning on you.
Okay, we can't even achieve our agenda items. We're going to turn on you.
Right.
That's the big question. But I love that... Brad Sherman and Al Green are like, we're not waiting for any of this shit.
Nope.
There is already enough, like... there's already so much we could impeach him for.
Right. Like, we're going to start here and just head forward. So congratulations to our honorable mentions and to Brad Sherman, jazz flautist extraordinaire, and Al Green. Okay, Sarah. So...
Deep breaths.
It's been a long episode.
Yeah.
Last but not least, let's talk about some action items. So some things that Hellions can do after they listen to the pod.
Yeah. So first of all, the Women's March is planning a march from the NRA headquarters to the DOJ. So they'll be making a 17-mile trek from Fairfax, Virginia. So that's where the NRA headquarters are, to the DOJ in D.C., so the first rally, that kickoff rally in Fairfax, will be at 9 a.m. on July 14th, and they'll hold another one on July 15th at noon in D.C., so when they get to the DOJ. This is in response to the NRA staying silent on Philando Castile's death. The Women's March organizers said in a statement, quote, since the acquittal of Officer Yanez for shooting and killing Philando Castile in Minnesota, the NRA has failed to make any statement defending the civil rights of Mr. Castile, a law-abiding gun owner who can be heard in video footage clearly notifying the officer that he was carrying a licensed firearm. The NRA claims to stand for the Second Amendment rights of all Americans, but their silence on Mr. Castile's constitutional rights to own a gun betrayed a deep hypocrisy that many joined in calling out. They're also sort of responding to that incendiary ad that the NRA put out that was not so subtly calling for, like, a civil war, like, against activists, basically. Yeah, it was really creepy.
Yeah, it was super creepy.
And they've also gone directly after one of the Women's March co-chairs, Tamika Mallory, which was also super gross.
Right. So they're just like, you guys, we are putting you on blast.
Yes. So if you live in the area, we really highly recommend that you take part. Definitely if you live in D.C., make sure you go to the rally at noon on Saturday at the DOJ. That's on July 15th.
Yeah. So next, net neutrality is still in jeopardy. We haven't talked about this in a while.
Yeah.
But this is something that I like to rage about.
Yes.
You know, there is a lot going on, and I totally understand that, but this is really important. We need to keep our eyes on net neutrality because this is a silent but very dangerous issue that affects everyone.
Yes.
We are so connected online, and we talked to Tracy Chow about it today. You know, the internet is shaping the way we communicate.
Right.
And, you know... the free and uncensored exchange of information is the bedrock of democracy, I'm just saying. And I'm also just saying that think about how much more Twitter would suck if only people who paid for it could use it.
Ugh.
Awful.
Awful.
Awful. So battleforthenet.com has an easy way to send an email to your rep and to the FCC to let them know that this issue is important to you.
Yeah.
So just keep your eyes on this and, you know.
Don't sleep on net
neutrality. Don't sleep. Yes.
Swing Left also has a summer challenge. So from July 29th to September 29th, they'll be going out into Democratic neighborhoods in swing districts across the country to talk to voters and make sure they're ready to get to the polls. Studies have shown that getting people to commit to voting can lead to as much as a close to 4% increase in voter turnout.
Which is huge. It doesn't sound like a huge number, but a 4% increase is a lot.
I mean, you think about the last presidential election.
Right.
It was like 70, 80,000 votes across three states.
Right.
When, you know, there was millions upon millions and millions of ballots cast.
Right.
So sign up, do some internet training, and canvas swing districts near your area. So, I mean, I think this is really important. Our votes are our power, especially in this age, especially when the Trump administration is trying to suppress the vote even more.
Right.
And, you know, districts are gerrymandered half to death.
Right.
And we want 2018 to be a wave.
Right.
And this is a really powerful thing you can do.
Yes. And finally, we have your daily healthcare reminder.
Jesus fucking Christ, healthcare.
Jesus fucking Christ. Pester your senators. They work for us.
Yeah. We pay them.
We pay them. So call them and give them a piece of your mind. This is an especially crucial next few days and weeks since the CBO score is coming out soon. So just continue to, like, get your voice heard and tell your senators what you think.
Senators.
I mean,
you can still call your House reps.
I mean, yeah.
That doesn't hurt.
Ring, ring, ring. Hi, Brad Sherman.
Brad Sherman's like, I got you. Now I'm going to go play the jazz flute.
Exactly.
We're really taking that too far.
We're gonna keep that joke going forever.
Yeah, but I really do think that the longer this goes on, the harder it will be for them to pass the bill because people are making their voices heard and the work you're doing is so powerful. So make sure you do that. And then finally, please continue calling your senators about Kate's Law and the No Sanctuary for Criminals Act. The former would enact extreme punishments for undocumented immigrants, and the latter would infringe on the ability of local law enforcement to protect their communities. And just on a personal note, when I called Dianne Feinstein's office yesterday, she's one of my senators, our senator, the person taking my call wasn't aware of these measures at all. Like, he had to write it down.
Right.
So it's definitely flying below the radar, but it's a super, super crucial bill.
Yes.
So make sure to let your senators know that you want them to oppose both. Mm-hmm. And fivecalls.org is a great resource, and it provides helpful scripts for concerned citizens.
On like all yourself. Sorts of issues.
On all sorts of issues.
So you can pick your issue, pick your senator, and they have scripts.
Yeah.
It's so an amazing tool.
It's a really good tool. So several action items for you.
Yes.
Long show.
Long show.
Long show, but we got through it.
We did.
We thought it was going to be like 7 hours long. I think we got it down.
To like 4.5. We're fine.
But we're going to do a bonus podcast on Patreon.
Right.
So for those who support us with $5 and up a month, we will see you on there. And then for everyone else, we'll see you on Monday.
Thank you for listening. For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. You can follow Devin on Twitter at DevinHandy, and you can follow Sarah on Twitter at Sarah Lerner.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/HellbentPodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent. And there are lots of other fun rewards for higher levels of patronage, including a monthly Skype session with Devin and Sarah.
And for that one, drinking is optional.
Optional.
Quote, quote unquote. Quote.